Welcome. I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and you are listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. Sexual abuse from trauma can be so difficult to report or even speak about. Sexual trauma inflicted on a person with disabilities can be even more difficult to articulate and is more prevalent than is being talked about. According to the Disability and Abuse Project, children with developmental disabilities and mental health diagnoses are 5 times more likely to be sexually abused than children without disabilities. Today, I will be speaking with mental health and disabilities advocate Nellie Galindo. Following our discussion, we will speak with Anna Myers, who is a survivor of multiple sexual assaults and lives with a learning disability. She will discuss how her disability was used against her. First of all, I want to welcome Nellie Galindo. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, you know, as we talk about the abuse of people with disabilities, intellectual disability and developmental disability, how do you differentiate between the two?
Very often you'll see this population referred to just as people with IDD. So they tend to be lumped together, but they are two distinct groups. A developmental disability is a much wider range of people. It's more of an umbrella term that can include an intellectual disability. And essentially what it boils down to is just that it is a disability that is apparent during your developmental years, during your childhood. And that can also include disabilities like Down syndrome, which are congenital, that you're born with. The intellectual disability, that is when there is significant limitation in intellectual functioning. That is also something that comes before the age of 18. You know, so someone who gets a traumatic brain injury later in life, that would not be considered an intellectual disability. And for a lot of folks, you can have both a developmental disability and an intellectual disability.
Not many people talk about sexual abuse in the community of people with disabilities. It's really not talked about.
You know what? There are so many different reasons. I think it honestly is just a very uncomfortable topic, as it is for any other population, right? It's kind of that thing over in the corner that we know exists and we know it's happening, but we just don't want to touch it. There is also just a lot of myth around disability and sexuality in general, especially for folks with IDD. We just do not consider them to be sexual beings, or we just don't consider the disability community as a whole to be sexual or to be attractive or to be desired. I mean, it's just a really damaging, persistent myth. And then along with that, sexual abuse is really just about power and control, right? Mm-hmm. It really does. It has nothing to do with sexual pleasure. It's really just using someone's sexuality against them and controlling and having power over that person. And people with disabilities in general, again, big myth. They're often seen as very weak, very vulnerable, very dependent, and that can just make them seem like an easy target.
And I wanted to go into how sexual abuse affects people who live with developmental or intellectual disabilities. My abuse manifested in really risky behavior, anger, just intense feelings I couldn't control. Mm-hmm. How does something like that affect someone who lives with a disability?
Yeah, so I think what you described, just the very intense feelings, you know, whether it's feelings of anger or sadness or depression or anxiety, all of that can occur for somebody with a disability. Another damaging myth is that trauma in general is not going to affect someone with IDD like someone without an intellectual or developmental disability. And that's false. They have feelings and, you know, they have emotions just like everyone else, and they can be just as impacted by trauma as any person of the general population. And a lot of times what you'll see, because some folks in this community cannot necessarily verbalize what mm-hmm. they're feeling, a lot of those feelings are going to come out in behaviors. So that could be self-injurious behaviors like hitting your head against the wall or just other violent acts, emotional outbursts, you know, becoming very angry, becoming very irritable. And unfortunately, a lot of staff don't recognize this as a potential trauma response, a lot of the time they just contribute it to their disability.
I was basically told I was a bad kid, and I believe that for the majority of my life. I'm just this bad person. And then 20 years later, I realized these were symptoms of my PTSD.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And I think the exact same thing can happen to someone with an intellectual or developmental disability. And the other thing I want to mention too is that, again, just like with the general population, you are more likely to be abused by someone you know versus someone you don't know. It's not the stranger hiding in the bushes at the park. It's someone who's usually close to that individual.
Yeah,
and so for a lot of individuals with disabilities, their caregivers are also the perpetrators. So if you do have a direct support staff who is abusing a person with a disability living in a congregate setting, I mean, they are with their perpetrator 8 to 16 hours a day, and they may be dependent on that individual for things like bathing and dressing. That is also something that a lot of IDD organizations have to struggle through and struggle with as well, is that, you know, most often for the folks they are caring for, it is the caregivers who are perpetrating the violence.
Are there people, support staff, caregivers, who are trained to look at things like that?
Most, if not all, disability serving organizations who have direct care staff or who provide direct care, they have to be trained in crisis prevention and intervention. So they do go through training to understand, you know, how environment impacts behavior, impacts how you react to someone, or they are also trained in ways to respond to behavior that is unsafe. So if they need to restrain someone, like holding someone's arms back, they do get that training. I think what is lacking, though, is the understanding of the trauma-informed care aspect of that, that you really have to focus more on preventing the crisis and de-escalating the crisis, because a lot of folks will just jump straight into, oh, they're screaming, they're hitting the wall, I have to restrain them. I mean, the wall is a thing, you can fix it. Restraining that person or holding that person down, sometimes that is re-traumatizing for an individual. I think we've come a long way with training staff and being able to give them the skills that they need to react in crisis situations, but I don't know that we're quite there yet when it comes to understanding the trauma aspect of why folks might be having these behaviors in the first place, and then how to reduce, you know, potential triggers in the environment that could be causing that to happen in the first place.
When I was looking for a treatment center, it's so rare to find a treatment center that is trauma-informed, especially on the East Coast. So I can imagine for caregivers, being trauma-informed is kind of a rare thing.
I'm seeing more research that's moving in the direction of recognizing that IDD organizations can and should be trauma-informed organizations. But it's definitely something that has not traditionally been part of that organizational mindset. But I'm hopeful that in the future we can
Absolutely.
Get there. Yeah.
We were talking about how children who receive special education in schools are excluded from sexual health classes and receive no sex education. It's not a requirement to be taught consent and healthy relationships and safer sex. Why is this? And what are the consequences of not having these discussions with people with disabilities?
Yeah, so I think this really varies state to state. I feel like every state kind of has their own guidelines for teaching sex ed in school. And some states have great sexual health education programs and some are not so great. So even the kids without disabilities aren't getting that great of an education. Mm-hmm. But again, especially for the kids in school who are in special education classrooms and are not mainstreamed in with their peers, again, there's just such a lack of accessible sexual health education. So even just being able to give them this information in a format that is accessible to them, that is at their cognitive or developmental level, mm-hmm. is really rare. That a lot of that just doesn't exist, or it's very hard to come by. And a lot of teachers, educators, special education staff are also just not trained in that as a learning topic. You know, this is typically, I think, the stereotype, like the gym teacher comes in and teaches everybody.
Right.
You know,
that's
I think
exactly
that's,
what
yeah, like you get that one brave soul at the school who can come in and teach. You know, a lot of schools are not going to outside experts to provide this information. And also, so some of the research I've looked at has actually seen that the predictive aspect of whether or not a child with a disability is going to get sex education in school or not really has to do with their communication skills. So if they have a more functioning communication, they are more likely to receive sex education than some of the kids who may be nonverbal or who have severe or profound intellectual disability. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, you know, just like those kids need math and science and reading and language, you know, to the best extent that they are able, they need this information as well. They need information about consent. They need information about bodies, about the correct names for body parts. You know, does the child who has a communication board have the word penis on there, the word vagina on there to be able to express if something does happen to them? So again, just that ability for communication and understanding how to communicate is really what's critical, I think, when it comes to sexual health education. But another interesting thing that I also want to mention is that the federal law, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, that's the act that requires all public schools to integrate children with disabilities and to serve and educate them in their school setting. That law doesn't say anything about sex education. So, you know, it says you have to provide, you know, the same access to education for your disabled students as your non-disabled students, but it really doesn't give any guidance to anything like sexual health education, you know, which is kind of, I think, seen as an elective of sorts. So that kind of language missing from the law, I think, is also kind of interesting and also critical to the whole issue at hand.
What are some of the differences in abuse that children and adults with disabilities encounter that someone without a disability may never have to experience?
They're more of a disability-specific abuse that person can go through. And this is really just when the abuse is using the person's disability against them as a form of violence. So, for example, taking away someone's wheelchair or taking away their crutches so they cannot walk, they cannot physically escape, or taking away someone's medications, even over-medicating someone, giving too much of a medication to affect their mood and their body, and even some emotional abuse. So if somebody said, you know, nobody's ever going to love you because you're retarded, or they use, you know, very pejorative, ableist terms, I mean, that's very abusive in some situations, but it's very pointed to that person's experience as a disabled person.
And I know that it would be harder for someone, especially who is nonverbal, to report abuse, but what are some of the reasons why it's harder for someone with a disability to report?
Often, so folks can have difficulty with communication. You know, I think, again, there's kind of a misconception that a person who is nonverbal is non-communicative, and that's not true. They just have to find the best form of communication that works for them, whether it's, you know, using sign language or using a communication board. But not all providers, I mean, not even a lot of disability providers are well trained in how to understand alternative forms of communication. So that can really place a barrier up for a lot of folks. A lot of that difficulty with communication can also affect individuals who are reporting, who are bringing forward their stories. A lot of forensic teams, law enforcement, don't know how to interview a victim with an intellectual disability, or they don't know how to collect forensic evidence with someone who's nonverbal. This also happens a lot with the deaf individuals. You know, some folks with IDD are also deaf, and so not having that those skills or that ability to communicate effectively with the individual, it can affect how a law enforcement proceeding may go forward. And also just because of that, whether it's because of an intellectual disability or just a communication disability, a lot of times these individuals are not seen as credible. They're not seen as being a credible reporter because maybe they cannot clearly articulate when something happened or all of the details of right. what occurred. And so that perception that they just are not reliable in their reporting is also putting up a big barrier.
Nellie, thank you so much for joining me today. That was mental health and disabilities advocate Nellie Galindo. If you would like to find out more about Nellie and the amazing work she's doing, please go to my website, atstpodcast.com. That's the letter A, tstpodcast.com. There you will find links to her articles plus her social media handles. Up next, we speak with trauma survivor thriver Anna Myers.
Welcome back. I'm Lori Lee Benstock, and you are listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. Joining me now is Anna Myers. Anna, you are so brave for speaking with me today, and I'm so grateful for your time.
Thank you.
Not only are you a trauma survivor, but you also live with a learning disability. Can you tell me a little bit about your story?
My learning disability, it's not dyslexia, but it's specifically, it affects my reading and comprehension skills, as well as a few other things. I specify that it's not dyslexia, though, because it functions differently. And a lot of people get that confused, and I don't, and there's not an official title for what I have, which is makes doctor's appointments fun, as you can imagine. But I have a learning disability, as well as ADHD and bipolar and depression. So I'm full up on all problems, you know?
A lot of us are.
Yeah. But my story with trauma, it started when I was about 15. I started dating a boy about 2 years older than me named Blake, and my parents did not like him, but I ignored them, you know, as
any 15-year-old.
Yeah, as 15-year-olds want to do. And as I continued to date him, he began to become both emotionally, mentally, and sexually abusive. He would force me to do things I did not want to do sexually, to the point that I was raped multiple times.
Sorry.
Thank you. And that's hard, but honestly, it was almost harder to deal with the emotional abuse that went along with it, because he spent the 2 years that we were dating cutting me off from all of my friends, and even cutting me off from my family, convincing me to lie to my parents all the time, and telling me that I was not smart and not pretty and all other horrible things that aren't true, but if you're told it enough, you start to believe it. And that, combined with the sexual abuse, went on for about 2 years before he tried to get me to stop speaking to my last friend I had, and I had always chosen him over my friends. And this time I was like, I chose my friend over him, and we ended up breaking up. And over the course of the next 2 years, he would stalk me and harass me.
Did you mention that he was older?
Yes. He was 2 years older than me. I actually met him because he was supposed to be a peer mentor to the freshmen. So I met him in arguably dubious circumstances, because he was, by the rules of the school, not supposed to date anyone that he was mentoring.
Right.
And he still went ahead and pursued dating me despite those rules. So it was a little bit of a secret, and that, I think, added to the unfortunate power dynamic that went at play there.
Absolutely.
Do you feel that your disability was used against you at all during this time where he was being abusive?
Yes, I think it was used against me. As someone with low self-esteem with my intelligence because of my learning disability, he would often quite literally say things like, well, you can't understand this because of your disability, or you're not smart enough to understand this. And he used both the actual disability as a reason why I couldn't do certain things or I couldn't understand certain things as an excuse for why it was okay he was doing things that he was doing, mm-hmm. while at the same time doing the grooming thing of saying, oh, you're so much more mature than all the other people your age. And
right, very confusing.
Yes, I can attest that it was a very confusing 2 years.
So he was a mentor to you in school?
Yes. And for the freshmen and sophomores, they had junior and senior mentors that went to the classrooms and were supposed to help guide you through school.
You know, for me, after my sexual abuse, I was self-harming, using, you know, abusing substances, and had multiple suicide attempts, among many other risky behaviors. How did your assault affect you?
If I'm being completely honest, I repressed it for several years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I knew it hadn't been a good relationship, but I didn't start to remember everything until after he started stalking me, actually. And I started to remember things that he had done that I had kind of forgotten about, that I had repressed. Like, mm-hmm. I knew he had taken advantage of me sexually, but I didn't remember how much or how often until about a year and a half later. Once I started realizing and remembering that more, I kind of handled it by joking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
like,
honestly,
a coping skill.
Yeah. Which honestly, sometimes I still do, but I try not to do it as much because I know it's not a good coping mechanism. But when I went to college, I moved all the way across the state. Part of that was because the college I wanted to go to was on the other side of the state, but part of that was also because I was scared, and I was scared of him, and I was scared of the other people who had traumatized me that lived in the town I grew up in. There were actually multiple times where I would just happen to see one of these people at the movie theater.
Right, and that'd be kind of triggering.
Yeah, and so I permanently moved to the town I went to college in.
Did you ever report any of the assaults?
No, partially because I didn't really recognize them for what they were until so much later. Partially because I've had bad encounters with police, which is, you know, traumatic on a whole other level. I just don't trust enough that anything would have happened, anything would have been done, because I was scared.
I completely understand. Like, I feel like there is always this fear that they won't believe you, or that you're just trying to seek attention. I feel like there are a number of reasons why people don't report assaults.
Yeah.
How did you heal from all of this trauma?
Well, I'll say I'm still healing in a lot of ways. Therapy is expensive, but really what... excluding therapy, because that's something I'm still working with and still going to for all of this, because it is a long process, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, how I've gotten to where I am today is by getting a group of friends that I trust and that I love, and getting a partner that I trust and who understands that sometimes I have flashbacks, and who is very understanding of my needs and doesn't take advantage of situations. And the biggest thing is for me was family and friends, because having a great support system has been the biggest help for me.
Mm-hmm.
Through all of this is just the friends and the family that have been there and are willing to talk with me about these things and don't judge me for when I'm having bad days, mm-hmm. or when I'm having rough times, and are just there.
Yeah, I think a support system, a good support system, can really take you far. It is unfortunate that mental health care is really a privilege. No one should be putting up with all the repercussions of these assaults and this abuse. It's something that really should be taken care of. And I hope you are able to get that care. What message would you give to others who may be struggling with life from past trauma?
One of the biggest things I would say is that time really does help, but also to trust your friends and trust your family, that if you're with someone and no one that you've known for longer, like none of your friends or none of your family, if they think that this person is a bad person, then to trust them. Sometimes, you know, rose-colored glasses are actually a big problem. You don't see the problem until it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that was a problem that I had to deal with, was I didn't realize I was dating someone abusive until it had gotten to such an extreme point in my life.
Yeah.
And so I think trusting your friends, trusting your family, and not letting them go, whether your family is blood or found family, whatever your family is to you, to trust them, because they're the people that matter most and they just want the best things for you, and that talking to people helps, and that it's better to talk about these things than it is to stay quiet about them.
I agree. I feel like the more you keep secrets to yourself, the more the trauma will manifest in other ways, like aggression and anger. I feel like for me, once I spoke about my sexual abuse, you know, it took me 20 years to actually say it out loud. You know, within that time period, it was really hard for me to kind of live life. But I feel like once I did speak my truth, everything changed, and changed for the better. And you are helping so many people by talking about what you're doing.
Thank you.
That was trauma survivor, thriver, Anna Myers. If you want to learn more about Anna, please visit atstpodcast.com. That's the letter A, tstpodcast.com. There you can find her social media handles and links to her blogs, as well as links and social media handles for my earlier guest, Nellie Galindo. Thank you for being a part of the conversation. I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and you've been listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. Take care.